For 250 years, Americans have debated what it means to pursue happiness, the freedom to build a meaningful life, and to shape the country's future. In this series, we'll explore some of the people, ideas, music, myths, and cultural forces that have shaped America, and how that history still influences the way Americans see themselves and each other today. And we'll begin with an icon, the man who led the Continental Army to victory during the Revolutionary War, our nation's first president, our capital's namesake, found on our money and on countless street signs. Today, we're going to go beyond the myths surrounding George Washington to better understand the man. I'm Judy Woodruff, and welcome to our new limited podcast series, In Pursuit of Happiness. It's part of our reporting project, Crossroads, America at 250. We're going to go beyond the myths with historian Lindsay Chervinsky, executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. Lindsay, we've already talked with you a couple of times this year. We sat down with you at Mount Vernon to kick off this series of Crossroads reports. We've also sat down with you recently at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, just as we were on the cusp of the 4th of July. Welcome back to Crossroads.
Thank you. America at a Crossroads. Thank you for having me back.
For sure. So the house that explains the man, you had told us that his study at the house was the most private place when he was there, where he did a lot of thinking. What was it about the house, about the place, that was so important to him?
Well, you really can't understand George Washington, and you certainly can't write about him unless you've spent time there, because it was his most favorite place. And it was the place he longed to go back to whenever he was somewhere else. And so the house tells us a lot about him, because it features his commitment to innovation. The surrounding farmlands demonstrate how innovative he was in his thinking, how committed he was to the newest science. But the house also reveals his extraordinary wealth. It reveals the image he wanted to put forward to people who were visiting and put forward to future generations of Americans. And it reveals how private he was. The whole side of the house that was his study and their bedroom, you couldn't access it from the main part of the house unless you were welcome there. He had a separate entrance and a separate staircase to allow him to avoid the thousands upon thousands of visitors that flocked to Mount Vernon to see him.
So, and he got around that. He had a private access from one part of the house to his study.
Yes. So, Southern hospitality at the time really required people of wealth to host anyone who came to visit. It didn't matter if they were a stranger. And because he was the most famous man in the world, he was the father of the nation, people visited Mount Vernon as though it was a shrine. And he was someone to pay homage to. And so, after his presidency, he wrote in his diary that he and Martha only had about two nights where they didn't have to share their dinner with someone else.
My name is Dee Gerritsen, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'd love to know how George Washington ended up living at Mount Vernon, and did he buy it? Did he inherit it? Did it come with his wife?
We had viewers write and ask, you know, how did he come upon it? Did he, his family always own the land? Did he inherit it? In fact, his father had built the house, and then he, when his father passed and then his older brother passed, he then took it over.
That's right. So his father, Augustine Washington, was the first to build a property on that land for the Washingtons. And it was about a 1.5-story house. So it had one story and a garret. It was much smaller. So if you saw it today, he would not recognize it. And then when Augustine died, it was passed down to Lawrence Washington, who was George's older half-brother. And he was the one that named it Mount Vernon. It was named after Admiral Vernon, a British admiral who had been Lawrence's commander, which I think is, you know, a unique twist of history.
And when you go there, I mean, one of the first things is what the house is made out of, because
yes,
it looks like it's stone.
Yes, that's right. It was made out of wood. The initial house was fairly modest. Stone was extremely expensive. And when Washington was first making additions to the house, he didn't have enormous wealth. And so they do this sort of stamped process where they put wet sand up on the wooden boards and then basically carve out edges to make it look like stone, which I've, you know, stood in the line as visitors have gone through the house, and occasionally they're a little disappointed by that.
And you're still doing archaeological study work at the house, and there was a really interesting find just a couple of years ago. Tell us about that.
Oh, gosh, this is amazing. Well, we are constantly doing archaeological work at Mount Vernon because there's so much to discover at any given moment. There had never been an archaeological study done of the cellar of the house because, in general, best practice for archaeological work is not to disturb land unless you have to. So the cellar was intact, and then a couple of years ago, we started this massive restoration project to basically rebuild the foundation in the cellar of the house. And so it gave us an opportunity to actually do proper archaeological work. And one of the things that our amazing team discovered was a forgotten pit that had over 35 intact glass bottles of fruit, mostly cherries. And you don't usually find one bottle, let alone 35. And so what we believe happened was there was extra fruit. They were bottled. They were bottled using the recipe by an enslaved woman named Dahl. And George was quite specific that it was to be that recipe. And then the pit was covered. It was a way to sort of do refrigeration at the time. You would dig down into the ground. And then he went away to war. And at some point, stones were put over it and it was forgotten. And so until we did this archaeological work, people had forgotten that this pit was there. And what's amazing is because of the Virginia clay, the tops had, they were sort of wax seals, and that had corroded over time. But the water that came through the clay was so perfectly distilled by the clay that the fruit is still food grade quality.
Meaning it's edible?
I mean, I wouldn't suggest it because they're gray, but we sent them to the USDA for testing, and they are still food grade edible.
And is there reason to think that there are still other things to be found?
Well,
underground, around?
We did a pretty comprehensive archaeological survey of the cellar, but we have not done a complete archaeological survey of all 400 acres that we currently control. And Washington had just under 8,000 acres when he died. So there is always more to learn.
You shared with us what how detail-oriented mm-hmm. he was, that he was mm-hmm. He was experimenting with agriculture, mm-hmm. with farming, changing the crops from tobacco to other things. Where did all that come from?
I mean, yes.
there's a lot
there's so
to
much
share.
There. So, I mean, Washington was first and foremost a plantation owner. That was where his wealth came from. And he was meticulous about making sure that he managed it in such a way that he didn't go into debt, because so many plantation owners did. So he was one of the first Virginia planters to switch from tobacco to wheat, recognizing how terrible tobacco was for the soil and that the profits were really decreasing. And then he experimented with other things like corn and other crops. He developed his own 7-year rotation. So he has this chart that had, you know, which fields were going to be on which part of the 7-year rotation. He came up with his own compost recipe, and much of this information he acquired by reading, because he didn't have a formal education, or at least not much of one, and he was constantly buying books on the newest science and agricultural technology from Scotland and England. He was always trying to learn more. And then, of course, the enslaved population was largely the ones implementing this labor, but he was committed to always try new things, learning more and being at the cutting edge of what agriculture looked like. And that included the livestock. So he recognizes that horses were expensive and they needed a lot of food and they tended to get injured easily. And donkeys are very stubborn. There's a reason we have that cliche.
Yeah.
And so he bred a Spanish donkey that he received as a gift from the King of Spain. And its name was Royal Gift, because of course, with a horse, and produced the first American mule. So he is recognized as the father of the American mule, which was essential to things like the expansion of the American West, because you can't really farm without good livestock.
We hear a lot about, you know, Jefferson and Adams and Franklin being so well educated, whether on their own or through some sort of schooling, but I never hear about George Washington. I would like to know if there are any particular books that really influenced his thoughts.
He didn't have a formal education mm-hmm. or much of one mm-hmm. beyond his very early years, but he tried to make up for that. Mm-hmm. How conscious was he of that?
Oh, so unbelievably aware, especially as, you know, he was an adult because he was surrounded by people who did have that formal education. The higher classes in Virginia gentry went to William and Mary, they went to Princeton, they went to Harvard, or they went to school in Great Britain. And so he didn't have any of that experience. And some people, I think, would be crippled by that insecurity, or they would have such a chip on their shoulder that it would define them. And instead, he saw it as an opportunity to engage in lifelong learning. He bought books over the course of his life, but he also surrounded himself with people who knew more than he did. And he asked questions of them and learned from them, which I think is one of his most important leadership qualities.
When you, again, when we think of George Washington, we think of president, mm-hmm. general, Revolutionary mm-hmm. War, but there was this whole other side of mm-hmm. him that tells us a lot about him and his interests, what his priorities were mm-hmm. in life, detail-oriented.
You told us control freak. Yeah.
So what does that mean, control freak?
Well, he was extremely regimented in everything he did. His daily schedule was regimented. He was an incredibly ambitious person, and so he was ambitious for his plantation, for his economic prospects. He was ambitious about his political career, his military career. And that led to sometimes an element of control about, you know, what he did on a daily basis, what the enslaved population did on a daily basis, and what sort of records were kept to monitor all of that progress. So his farm records are almost immaculate. They are phenomenal because they tell us how much clothing each enslaved person received, tells us what duties were assigned to them, what farm they were assigned to, who they were married to, how many children they had, when they had medical care or had health issues. And it shows us how intensely focused he was on those details, but it also produces this incredible record where we can breathe life into the stories of people who are not usually documented in the written record.
You can't, of course, think about Mount Vernon without thinking about the enslaved
yes.
people who lived there, mm-hmm. who made it possible for him to lead the life that he did, for him and his wife, Martha. Tell us a little bit about how the picture at Mount Vernon mm-hmm. and the people who lived there who were enslaved fits in overall with what mm-hmm. was going on in Virginia at
yeah.
that time.
Well, Washington was born into an enslaveholding family. He inherited the first enslaved people that he owned when his father died. When he met Martha, he did own enslaved people, and he was buying and selling people without really much regard for the impact on their personal lives. But his scale shifted dramatically upon their marriage because she brought with her an enormous estate left to her from her first husband, Daniel Parke Custis, and left to her heirs as well. And so hundreds more enslaved people came under Washington's control when they got married. And it made him an extraordinarily wealthy man and put him at the very top of the Virginia gentry.
What do the records show, Lindsay, about what George Washington's view was mm-hmm. of blacks, of the enslaved mm-hmm. people?
Well, I think this part of the story is so important because certainly early on in his life, and at least through part of the Revolution, he was not an ardent advocate for slavery in the way that we think of Virginians perhaps in the 1840s or 1850s. He didn't ever consider it a positive good. He understood that it was actually bad for the economy, especially after he switched to wheat. It was not a productive form of labor. He recognized the pervasive effect, or the pernicious effect, I should say, on both the enslaved and the enslaving. It made people disinclined to work hard because either they weren't laboring for wages or they didn't have to labor themselves. But he didn't actively do anything about it. The real shift occurred during the Revolution. And while he didn't necessarily write about his thinking on why it shifted, I think we can attribute it to interacting with abolitionists like the Marquis de Lafayette, who gave him anti-slavery tracts. witnessing free Black populations in cities like Philadelphia and Boston, and then critically, the unbelievable valor of Black troops in the Continental Army.
In his will, he said his slaves, all of them, would be set free upon the death of Martha.
Correct.
His wife.
Yes.
Not upon his death.
Correct. Yes. And what's interesting is she actually decided to emancipate them early. And we don't 100% know the reason why, but there was some speculation that she worried that they would hasten that process along, and so she emancipated them before she died.
My name is Gil Agutter. I'm from Brier, Washington. George Washington had a seemingly troubled relationship with Native Americans. What is his legacy of his treatment of them?
So, as we know, Lindsay Chervinsky, it isn't just the people who were enslaved who were a complicated part of George Washington's legacy. It's also Native Americans he came in contact with. And there weren't nearly as many in his life, proximity to him in his life, close to him in his life. But they certainly played a role
Hugely
from his
important
earliest
role.
Days.
Yeah, Native nations still retained an enormous amount of power in the 18th century, political power, diplomatic power, military power. So his first interactions occurred in the 1740s when he went out west as a surveyor and he's meeting Native peoples for the first time. He then, of course, fought alongside and against Native peoples during the Seven Years' War with some mixed consequences. Washington kind of started the Seven Years' War, which turned into a global conflict. So not a great track record there. And then they were also critically important during the Revolution. And so he had a very good diplomatic relationship with the Oneida. They sided with the Americans, while some of the other Iroquois nations sided with the British. But again, that too is mixed because while he had enormous respect for the way that Native peoples fought war and actually learned a lot about their tactics and implemented some of them himself, he also adopted very brutal repressive strategies against the Indian nations that were allied with the British and at times ordered entire towns to be wiped out in retaliation for attacks that they had made on American settlements. So it was a brutal, full type of warfare.
You said he adopted some of their fighting, their tactics in fighting. Any example of that?
Well, what Native people did so well was they understood the environment they were fighting in and they used that to their advantage. So whether that be tree cover or where you position yourself or even clothing designed to blend into the environment. And these were all things that Washington adopted. And not right away. At the very beginning of the war, he was still kind of fighting like a British general. But as the war went on, he adopted some of those tactics and, of course, learned from their knowledge.
Camouflage rather than bright primary colors.
Exactly.
What about after that? When he was president, I know that's on the record, the westward expansion.
Yes.
You know, was happening.
Well, Washington saw Native nations as either allies or enemies, depending on who they were, which side they sided with in conflicts against the British and the French. And he saw them as independent nations. They were treated as sovereign nations. But he also recognized that he didn't have the military power or the political power to stem westward migration and to stem the flood of Western settlements that were provoking these clashes on the Western regions of places like Pennsylvania and New York and Virginia and ultimately Kentucky. And so while he did actually have respect for Native nations and often hosted their chiefs and their leaders in Philadelphia at the president's house, there are amazing medals and stories of these dinners that they attended and they would pass a pipe around a circle. And so there's some really incredible stories of those interactions. He also wasn't really able to stem the violence that was provoked by Americans marching west.
You were saying a minute ago that he thought a lot about his legacy when it came to the enslaved people. Did he have the same view about his relationship with the indigenous people?
I don't know that he thought of his legacy purely in terms of the indigenous people. I would say he thought of his legacy in terms of foreign policy, and he would have lumped them into that bucket. So he thought it was essential to establish a foundation of neutrality. He talked about being friendly with all nations. So engaging in trade, engaging in intellectual discourse, being a part of a global community, but ideally not fighting with a lot of nations. And he tried to establish that foundation with Britain, with France, and also with Native nations.
There's so much to ask you about George Washington because there were so many parts of his life that we followed. Going back to his very early years, I mean, he was involved in a militia when he was a teenager.
Yes.
Right? I mean, yes. He was fighting in the Virginia.
Yes. Well, his best teacher was experience, and he saw a lot. He was a surveyor going out west to survey Fairfax lands when he was just a teenager. And that is a pretty remarkable experience. And then once the Seven Years' War, well, once he kind of started it, he was then a part of the Virginia Regiment. He had been a part of General Braddock's official family. And then he commanded a Virginia Regiment for several years during the Revolution.
His military record he was recognized early on, yes. And then of course there's criticism about some of the decisions that were made during the Revolutionary War. But he was recognized as a leader.
He was. I mean, bravery was never the problem. Early on, he made decisions. So, for example, Fort Necessity. This was after the initial conflict with French and Native allies. He built a fort as a defensive mechanism, and it was very poorly situated. He took none of the knowledge from Native allies at this point in his life, and many of his troops said that this was a poor place to build the fort, and he didn't listen. He was too stubborn and too proud to listen to that advice. Later on, he learned from that, and so he both learned how to better position his forces, but also who to listen to.
And the whatever lessons he learned or didn't learn in the years when he was wearing a uniform, of course, carried on to his time as president. We have a question, and we can't cover his entire president. We're not even going to try. But I do want to listen to one viewer who had a question about his cabinet.
Hi, I'm William Hedrick. I'm from Alamogordo, New Mexico. As a military commander and as the chief executive, why did he allow so much unresolved conflict within his inner core, both within the Revolution and once he was president, and specifically between Hamilton and Jefferson?
I love this question because it actually was central to his leadership. So because Washington didn't have a lot of the training, didn't have a lot of schooling, he intentionally surrounded himself with people who had a lot more knowledge, a lot more experience than he did, but also were different from one another. He wanted to have a lot of different perspectives. And he started this practice during the Revolution where he would call a council of war and he would pose a series of questions. He almost never went into a meeting with his mind made up. So he'd pose these questions and then he would allow his officers to debate. And that was by design because he wanted them to poke holes in each other's arguments. He wanted them to flesh out the weaknesses of the other position because it allowed him to try and get as much information and to have as many different ideas presented to him as possible.
And he and Hamilton, of course, were close and remained close until Hamilton's.
They did. But the thing is, you know, when Jefferson and Hamilton were disagreeing with each other, Washington sided with Jefferson almost 50% of the time. So the idea that Washington was controlled by Hamilton is total Jefferson propaganda. And instead, he was often trying to triangulate, to find a middle ground between the two, a more moderate position. But if you look at the cabinet records, it's almost as though he's counting. Because one day he's with Hamilton, and the next day he's with Jefferson. And then the next day he's with Hamilton, and the next day he's with Jefferson. He was meticulous about trying to find that middle ground. And I do actually think it made him a better president.
Why did he care so much about the middle ground? What was that all about?
Well, he was trying to be a president for all Americans, and they represented two distinct poles, two distinct visions of what the country could be, but they were also among the more radical perspectives of those two positions. And so by finding a middle ground, I think he believed he was best serving the nation.
We can't talk about Hamilton without thinking about the musical, without thinking about
not.
Ron Chernow's book,
yes.
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I'm Ann Taylor Rawls, and I live in Richmond, Virginia. who doesn't love Hamilton, of course. So I think that one is really fun. Personally, also being a native of Virginia, that one's really special because we think all the, you know, we grew up going on field trips to Yorktown and Williamsburg, and these are the places where our nation was founded and these exciting things happened. My 7.5-year-old can get really into that song, or she's listening to it with her friends. It's an opportunity for young kids to connect with this history and connect with the story of who we are as Americans.
So let's talk about the musical.
Yes.
And the portrayal especially of Washington and the song where he's making it clear he's going to stop serving after
Teach
them
how
terms.
To say goodbye is such
how,
a good song.
How well does the musical Hamilton capture Washington, do you think?
I think it does really well. I mean, first I should say I'm a huge fan, and I am both a huge fan of the art, but also anytime art can bring in new audiences to learn history, that is just such an extraordinary gift. And I have yet to meet a person who watches Hamilton, listens to Hamilton, and says, okay, I know everything. Instead, people say, what really happened? I want to know more. And they go and read books, and they go to museums, and they go to places like Mount Vernon. And what an extraordinary contribution to the American story. So as a huge fan, I think that they capture Washington really well. It is someone who is sort of above the fray, who is intentionally trying to be this larger-than-life figure in a way that rallies all Americans to their side. He's trying to manage the various different personalities that we just talked about. Doesn't always get it right. Has very much a temper that does occasionally come out. But the song Teach Them How to Say Goodbye is so valuable because it quotes from the farewell address. And so it draws on the primary document. It draws from Washington's words and gets at one of Washington's greatest contributions to the nation.
One last time, the people will hear from me. One last time, and if we get this right, we're gonna teach them how to say goodbye.
I'm not even going to try to sing it or even do come. If we get this right, we're going to teach him how to say goodbye, you and I. That's very powerful.
Well, it's so important because a republic is defined by three things: the rule of law, civil control of the military, and peaceful transfer of power. The peaceful transfer of power had to be taught because it didn't happen anywhere else in the world. This was the age of monarchies and military dictatorships. And the most recent transition Americans had seen was the French Revolution, which is not the model you're looking for when it comes to transitions. And so Washington understood that Americans had to be taught how to do this. They had to be taught to cherish a peaceful transition of power and to participate in the upholding of these institutions. And so I love how that song gets at this process that it has to be taught.
Did he ever have a desire to stay,
to be
the monarch or whatever, the democratic equivalent of a monarch?
Well, he may have personally after the war. I mean, there were people who were sending him letters saying, Congress is terrible. Why don't you just take power and rule? Because they don't know what they're doing. They're completely inefficient and ineffective. And he wrote very serious letters back saying, absolutely not. Civilian government is what it means to be a republic. But that decision must have been a hard one because he knew he was returning power to a government that didn't work. The Articles of Confederation Congress was terrible, and he knew it. He had advocated for all of these reforms, and then he played a critical role in replacing it with the Constitution just 4 years later. So it must have been incredibly difficult to give up power to a government that he knew was failing. But once he was the president, I mean, he went on to leave after one term. He didn't even want to be president. He accepted it because he knew he had to, but then he was very happy to leave that office.
So he steps away from the presidency, and he's the famous line about he wants to be sitting under his vine and
fig tree. Yes.
Which I guess he said that in several different
occasions. It's a biblical term, and so he's referencing this biblical term, and so he used it a lot.
He really did want to go home, mm-hmm. apparently, to mm-hmm. to Mount Vernon. And there were several years left in his life.
Yeah.
How did he spend those years? I mean, he didn't truly retire, did
no.
he?
No. I mean, most of his day-to-day was doing what he loved best, was farming. So he would get up every morning. He would spend a couple of hours with correspondence or his paperwork, have breakfast, and then go out and spend several hours on horseback and go to all five of his farms monitoring what was happening, come back for the big meal of the day, which was dinner, which was usually in the mid-afternoon, and then spend time with family or guests and then have a light supper before bed. He was pulled back into politics, and this was during the quasi-war, during the Adams presidency, when there was a real threat of war with France, and Congress created this big new army, and Adams asked Washington to be the commander-in-chief of this army. And Washington agreed as long as he could stay home at Mount Vernon until the French basically invaded.
Wait a minute. He's the commander-in-chief, uh-huh. but he's staying at home.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So what that meant was whoever was number two was going to have all the day-to-day power. And so that led to a huge squabble between Adams' cabinet and President Adams over who was going to be number two, because Adams didn't trust Alexander Hamilton. And they were all very loyal to Hamilton. And he had very good reason not to, because Hamilton had some wild ideas about what to do with this army. And Washington got dragged into it. He ultimately told Adams that he wouldn't take the position unless he had Hamilton. And I think later came to maybe regret that, because when Adams pursued diplomacy, Washington's last letter to Adams was a letter of support, saying, I applaud this decision, I support you in this policy, and you will have my support.
But that wasn't what happened later. Right?
Well, what's interesting is in 1798, they have this really contentious exchange where Washington basically threatens to resign his commission unless he gets his way. Yeah. And Adams obviously has to give in, because if Washington were to resign, then that would kneecap the Adams presidency. And so he gives in, but then pursued diplomacy and sent another peace commission in 1799. And that peace commission does produce the Treaty of Moredon-Fontaine. There isn't an actual war with France. And when he sent that peace commission, then Washington wrote to Adams and said, I support this action. So kind of came around and tried to mend fences a bit.
And then it wasn't long after that before Washington.
That's right. He died later that year.
Was out on his horse and mm-hmm. came down with some sort of throat infection. We're not clear.
Yeah, I mean, it's a disease today that would be solved with antibiotics and no problem. But basically, he had an infection and his throat was closing. And the doctors bled him, which made it worse because that leads to faster swelling. And so he was basically suffocated by his own throat.
And he was just in his 60s.
He was. And, you know, it's amazing because one of the reasons he wanted to leave the presidency was he said men in the Washington family don't live past their 50s. So he had already outlived his father, his brothers. He thought he was on borrowed time. But other than that, he was in exceptional health. He was still riding, you know, several hours a day and could have had a lot more time.
Why is it important today, 250 years mm-hmm. later, that we still focus as much as we do on George Washington? Yes, he was the first.
Sure.
But beyond that, why?
Well, so much of the world we're living in today is shaped by Washington in ways that we don't always really appreciate. So our institutions, things like the presidency, are still largely built on norm and custom. There isn't actually that much written about what the day-to-day shape of the presidency is supposed to be. And so much of that goes back to Washington's example. Most of his successors have modeled themselves on what they think his example was. So much of the world that we are living in, the institutions, things like the Constitution, they reflect Washington's participation. But on a broader scale, we are celebrating the 250th anniversary of what it means of a republic. And I mentioned those three things of what it means to be a republic, of the rule of law, civilian control of the military, and the peaceful transfer of power. Washington was essential to creating those things. And they're an incredible inheritance to have received, and for us to remember that they are things that were really hard to build and are really easy to tear down and require every generation to recommit to upholding them, including ours, so that we can pass it along to the following generations.
So we remember him, and we hold on the one hand him mm-hmm. in honor for all that he did that mm-hmm. brought the country together, mm-hmm. but we also remember his owning hundreds mm-hmm. of slaves mm-hmm. and not letting them mm-hmm. Go free, the decisions around Native Americans, mm-hmm. indigenous people. We hold all this in our mind at the same time.
We have to. It's the full story. The story of revolutionary America is not one of just a handful of white men. It required a full nation to build. But also it is a much more useful legacy, because if we're looking for perfect people to save us today, we're going to be sorely disappointed. But instead, if we say, well, here is a deeply flawed person who still managed to do extraordinary things, maybe we can look for flawed people today that can also do extraordinary things.
So a message for today.
Yes, absolutely.
From 250 years mm-hmm. and more.
Yes.
Lindsay Chervinsky, director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. Thank you.
Thank you. This was so fun.
Very much for sharing all these stories about our first president. Thank you.